Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And today is the deadline imposed by federal judge Dana Sabra of the Southern District of California to finish reuniting the roughly 2,500 children, ages 5 to 17, who were separated from their parents at the border under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. The government has faced an enormous challenge in its efforts to reunite these families. But Kirstjen Nielsen, the Department of Homeland Security secretary, told Fox News' Brett Baer that she was satisfied with the government's efforts.
Well, we're on track to do it. We're working hand in glove with HHS, and it's certainly our intention to reunify all families that are suitable.
Despite the government's optimistic outlook, they have deemed a significant number of parents ineligible for reunification, and hundreds of parents were reportedly deported ahead of their children. Joining me now is Caitlin Dickerson, an immigration reporter with The New York Times, and she's got the latest developments. Thanks for being with us, Caitlin.
Thanks for having me.
So today's the deadline. I think there's not much of a surprise that many of these kids have not been reunited with their families. Tell us where we stand right now.
So today we expect to see about 1,600 children finally reunified with their families. And those are the kids who have been deemed eligible after background checks and confirmation that people who claim to be their parents actually are, and also confirmation that the parents are still in the United States. But like you pointed out, that leaves almost 1,000 children still in federal custody for a number of reasons. And there's still a lot of work ahead, especially when it comes to those parents who were deported without their children. And the government doesn't know where those parents are right now.
So there's a lot of mess, it sounds, already. I want to go back to this idea of eligibility. Now, these were families who were separated at the border by the Trump administration, and now the administration is saying that these folks are ineligible. Where does that determination come from? Let's start there.
Sure. So ineligibility is a classification that government lawyers came up with to sort of limit the class size of this lawsuit to which this deadline, this very tough deadline, applies. And so there are a wide range of people who are considered ineligible, some of whom everybody sort of agrees, the ACLU who filed the lawsuit and the government, should not be returned to their children. Those are parents who have very serious criminal records, histories of child endangerment, sexual assault, things of that nature. No one's arguing for those children to be reunited with their parents. But certainly there are a lot of people who are deeply concerned about parents who were deported without their children, sort of, you know, the government's own work, and now have been lost somewhere in Central America. Those people, I think the ACLU would like to see have their children back as soon as possible.
And that just sounds traumatic to me. And you've reported on this for The New York Times, that 450 migrant parents we're talking about have been deported without their children.
Roughly, yes. I mean, there's one father in Guatemala who I spoke to last week, for example. He's illiterate. He's a potato farmer. He lives in a small town, and he speaks in the indigenous language. And he says he gets his news from the radio. He hasn't received any word from the United States government. He basically calls a consulate in Los Angeles every 4 days to ask for an update about his daughter. She was 5 when she went into custody, and she's turned 6. And he kept asking me over and over again, how long is it going to be until I see her? And of course, I couldn't give him an answer because there isn't an answer right now.
Now, do we know how many parents may have, quote unquote, self-deported, thinking that if they left the United States, this would make it easier for them to perhaps be reunited with their children?
This is a really tricky question. The government hasn't given us a firm answer as to how many parents signed orders of deportation versus how many were not given a choice. But it's also further complicated by this idea that the ACLU filed a motion actually yesterday saying that a lot of parents who signed and agreed to their deportation are now saying they don't know what they signed because the documents they signed weren't translated into their native languages, or they feel they were manipulated or forced to sign under duress. The father in Guatemala I mentioned told me that he was told by a border agent that he would have his daughter back in 2 weeks if he agreed to go home to Guatemala. It had been 4 weeks when I spoke to him, and he still had no news.
And do we know where his daughter is?
His daughter's in New York, and we know that because we're in touch with lawyers representing her as well. But sometimes even when you know where both parties are, there's very little that can be done.
So we heard at the top of the show, Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen talking about her views on how successful this has been so far. And I want to play you an additional clip in which she talks about some of the blame and where that should be placed.
Well, the part it's up to the parents. So if the parents contact us and they would like to be reunited, we, of course, will work with them. But as you know, the way the process works is the parents always have the choice to take the children with them. So these are parents who have made the decision not to bring the children with them, and then we'll continue to work with the court to understand how we can best comply with the order.
Caitlin, it sounds like she's putting the blame on the parents of these children. Is that accurate?
I think when it comes to the question of why we still see so many kids not reunited, it would be hard to place that blame on the parents since the kids were sort of forcibly taken away. And as far as delays go, I mean, we've heard sort of chaotic scenes playing out across the country where children have been sent to the wrong detention facilities, not where their parents actually are, you know, or sent to detention facilities only to then find out that their parents have actually been deported. And in places like Texas, where a lot of reunifications are happening, people are having to wait hours and even sometimes days, more than a week, to be reunited after they're brought to these facilities because there's such a backup, you know, to try to meet this court deadline. So there's a lot of logistical planning that really falls on the government that's happening at the very last moment, if at all. And I think that's responsible for most of the delays we're seeing now.
And we're also hearing about a lot of chaos happening at Port Isabel, where a lot of these reunifications is supposed to be happening. People put on buses without necessarily having enough food or anything. We're definitely going to be continuing to pay attention to this story. Caitlin Dickerson, immigration reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
When the Trump administration announced its zero-tolerance policy, the goal of the policy was to deter migrants from coming to the U.S. illegally.
Hopefully people will get the message and come through the border at the port of entry and not break across the border unlawfully.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking on Fox News back in June. But has this policy actually reduced the number of people migrating to the U.S.? Well, the data shows us that it hasn't. Last May, U.S. Border Patrol apprehended about 14,000 migrants. This past May, U.S. Border Patrol apprehended more than 40,000 migrants. That's almost three times as many. But the situation on the ground is a little more complex.
Yeah, people are not going to stop going to the U.S., you know, unless we have some actual jobs here. I mean, who the hell wants to work for, you know, $6 a day? You know, we need some real jobs.
That's 43-year-old Maurice, and he lived in the United States for most of his life, but was deported back to El Salvador 10 years ago. He spoke with Mexico City-based journalist Emily Green, who recently traveled to El Salvador to report on Central American migration for The Intercept.
What we hear is that people are fleeing violence, and that is absolutely true. But when I was in El Salvador, a lot of what I heard is that people aren't making any money, and they're living in very violent situations. And so I think it's a little bit a mix of the two and perhaps a more nuanced picture than a lot of what we hear in the United States. And that is not to say that there are not cases where it is purely violence and people's lives have been threatened. And they think that if they're going to stay or know that if they're going to stay, they will be murdered. But I think for the vast majority of people, it's some confluence of the two.
And when we zone in a little bit on family separation, the stated goal of this policy here in the United States was basically to prevent this migration at all from occurring. And I'm wondering, is the message getting through to people in Central America, particularly the folks that you interviewed in El Salvador?
What I heard in El Salvador from the many people that I interviewed, it is true for many months and a long time, people thought that the best way and the best chance for claiming asylum was to go with their young children. And many people did that. And the message is coming through loud and clear. Trump's family separation policy made front page news for days on end in the major Salvadoran newspapers. And there were pictures of kids in cages, etc. And so it was a big deal. And I did talk to people who said they would absolutely think twice or perhaps not go because they would be scared of being separated from their children. At the same time, various studies have come out, for example, from the Washington Office of Latin America called WOLA, that says Trump's family separation policy has made no difference. It is true that border crossings decreased in June, but that is to be expected. For the last 18 years, we have seen a decrease in border crossings in June because it's simply so hot and it's extremely dangerous to cross the border and the desert when it's so hot. So the statistics are not bearing out any evidence that Trump's family separation policy is making a difference. And I will say, you know, we might have to wait and see. For example, when Trump first took office, border crossings did decline a lot in those first initial months. But then within 12 months of his being in office, they had shot right back up to the Obama-level rates. So just because we see some trend one way or another in the first month, that by no means indicates what the longer-term trend is going to be.
Now, we also know, at least for the past couple of years, my understanding is that migration from Mexico has actually gone down. It's been on the decrease for a couple years now. And there are many different factors that play into that. But it still seems to be counter to the narrative that we keep hearing about all these, quote unquote, people coming across the border. Do you suspect that a similar trend could take hold perhaps longer term for migrants from Central America?
I don't think so. I mean, the situation, at least in El Salvador, is quite dire. It is very violent. And just to give you an illustration of that, there are so-called red zones in El Salvador, basically neighborhoods that are off limits. Now, I went to one of those neighborhoods only because I was visiting a church, and churches are somewhat safe ground, especially the evangelical church. And I went with a fixer, which is somebody, basically a Salvadoran reporter who was helping me navigate. And when we entered this neighborhood, he said to me, "Roll down your window," which surprised me because this entire time that I'd been in El Salvador, we had our windows rolled up. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because they want to see your face and they want to make sure that you're not an enemy and that you're not from a rival gang." Now, that just speaks to the degree of lawlessness and insecurity in El Salvador. And at the same level, the economy is really bad. I mean, I talked to so many people who are making less than $10 a day. One woman in particular, her name is Edith, makes $5.50 a day, and she is a live-in housekeeper and nanny. So if you put those together, the economy and the violence, I don't think that we're going to see a decrease in migration from the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala anytime soon.
And you mentioned Edith Tovar Rodriguez, and she had some pretty powerful stuff to say.
Sometimes the pastor says, "Edith, you tried twice already, and if God didn't give you the opportunity to go, it's because he doesn't want you there." But then I look at the reality here, the unemployment, the lack of freedom because of the gangs. When I look at what's happening in El Salvador, I feel motivated to try again.
Edith is a very religious woman. She has one free day a week, and she spends that entire day at church. So in some ways, she's sort of saying, "I'm defying the will of God." And that just speaks to the desperation that people feel. She feels like if she stays, she has zero future.
Emily Green is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Emily, thanks so much for talking with me about this.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Don't you have kids, Mr. President? It's wrong. It's not the America we know, and it's not biblical.
That is not America. That is not our values.
For God's sake, America, what is happening to your soul?
Kids who were just taken from the arms of their parents. Children in cages crying for their parents. This is child abuse. Has our nation lost its way?
Latino leaders in Congress have fought to be on the front lines of the fight against family separation. But what does leadership look like for a minority of lawmakers on Capitol Hill seeking to represent a group that is so socially and economically diverse? Today on The Takeaway, we'll begin exploring the role of Latino leadership in the United States, and I'm putting that question to Congressman Joaquin Castro. He represents Texas's 20th district, and he's the first vice chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's get started in saying and asking the question about the role that Latino leadership has had so far in the conversation about family separation. We heard some lawmakers speaking at the top of the segment, but give us a sense from where you stand.
Well, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and many of the Latino members in Congress have been at the forefront of calling attention to what we see as a humanitarian issue, which has been the separation of many young children from their mothers and fathers. And it was a decision that was made by the Trump administration to do that, and doing everything that we can to hold the administration accountable. So, for example, pressing them when they can't give us answers about a timeline for reunification or the identities of some of the children or parents, and the fact that many of the parents have been deported without being able to take their children back with them.
And thinking about the work that really needs to be done, I mean, this is a very divided country right now. It's a very divided Congress right now. At the end of the day, many of the folks that we're talking to are members of the Democratic Party, which is a minority party right now. What has it been like to attempt to make inroads, if any, with Republican leaders on the issue of family separation?
By and large, it's been difficult. And you're right. Many Latino leaders in Congress are members of the minority party right now, the Democratic Party. And anytime you're in the minority party, it can be tough to pass legislation that you'd like to see passed to address this issue or other issues. And so, I mean, your role is really to stand up and fight, to make sure that you call folks out on the issue. So that's what we've been doing. You know, this administration has been especially defensive and not especially transparent. And so we've sent a series of letters over to the Departments of Health and Human Services, the Department of State, of course, the Department of Homeland Security. And oftentimes we've not been given clear answers to those questions about what's happening with the kids and the parents.
Let's shift gears for a minute from family separation to some other issues that Latino voters are concerned about. And we often hear of this group of Latino voters broadly, which is extremely diverse, extremely on so many levels. We call them a sleeping giant, right? And often that's because of the low voter turnout. And people keep thinking, well, there's going to be this one thing that wakes up the sleeping giant. And it still doesn't seem to have happened. We talked to Mark Hugo Lopez over at the Pew Research Center, and he was, I'm going to play you a clip that he told us about the 2016 exit polls.
Immigration was important to many, but it wasn't necessarily the number one issue for Hispanic voters on election day. The issue of the economy, the issue of health care or education have oftentimes been among the top three, but immigration has been somewhere below those issues.
Your reaction to that, Congressman?
You know, that if the responses from that poll and survey are right, then I'm okay with that. I think Latinos have a wide range of issues that they care about in this country, just like other Americans. And it's true that this is a community that is very much, for many in the community, an aspiring community that's making its way up the socioeconomic ladder. So those issues are incredibly important. That said, immigration is still a very important issue to the Latino community, because many people have family members who are directly affected by the issue of immigration. So, you know, I don't necessarily see it as a competition between healthcare and immigration. I think all of these things are important for the community.
So there were some poll numbers that came out once again from our friends over at Pew. Back in 2013, which feels like decades ago, there was a poll that Pew did asking about Latino leadership in the United States. And this has stayed with me for ever since that poll came out. 62% of respondents said they did not know or could not identify a Latino leader. Here's Mark Lopez again.
Who's the equivalent of, say, a Cesar Chavez from the 1960s? The Latino population is very diverse. And when you talk to Latinos who are of Cuban origin, they're more likely to name somebody like Marco Rubio. When you talk to, for example, Puerto Ricans, they name Sonia Sotomayor.
Congressman, why do we have such a dearth of vision when it comes to who could potentially be a Latino leader? Is it us, or is it the fact that just it's not even a concept that's possible?
Well, as you know, I mean, and it was pointed out in that clip, the Latino community is actually made up of different subgroups, right? You know, you have Mexican Americans, Cuban Americans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, etc. They're distinct communities, but also, I mean, I think that leadership in some sense and the championing of the Latino community is an ensemble effort. It's an effort that is being undertaken by many people, including those in Congress, but also by many community leaders, many of whom never see their names in the paper in their hometown or see their faces on television, and we don't see those things. But still, they're doing the hard work of championing a community that needs champions and advocates. You know, there's so many groups made up of young dreamers, for example, that over the last few years, I think, have had a powerful impact on American politics and the discourse in American politics. And there isn't necessarily a singular leader from that movement. Yes, I think it'd be nice if there were one or two people that everybody could identify as the main folks, but you also don't want it to relieve everyone else of the responsibility of working as hard as they can to improve the lives of the people in their communities.
Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro is vice chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Congressman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
A little less than 300 miles south of Congressman Joaquin Castro's district in San Antonio is the Port Isabel Processing Center, an immigration facility in Brownsville, Texas, right near the border with Mexico. Debbie Nathan has been reporting on how Port Isabel has been handling the demands of today's deadline, and she joins us now from the Texas border. Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Port Isabel Processing Center was designated as the location where mass unification was supposed to happen. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of disorganization, you know, really to the point of chaos. All kinds of things. Like one thing is that kids come in from, you know, airplanes at all hours of the day and night, like sometimes at 3 a.m. And a few days ago, they were sleeping in the back rooms of Port Isabel, which is a facility that's only for adults. So that was kind of strange. And then for people who do have kids who've been reunited at Port Isabel, they're commonly taken to Catholic charities or other religious-based shelters. And they get bus tickets generally that their families have paid for, but they don't get anything except maybe a sandwich.
And these are bus tickets to go back to their home country?
No. These are, you know, these are people who are going to be going to friends or relatives. They've been released with their children. They might be going to something like a place like Rhode Island or California or Florida or North Carolina. So they're facing like a 35 to 48 hour trip. And maybe they've got a sandwich, and then that's gone pretty quick. And then this is a mother with kids or a father with kids. And then they've got the rest of this trip with no food and no water and no money, you know, for the next 1 or 2 days.
I want to play a clip of an interview that you did with a woman named Madeline Sandifer. Let's hear what she had to say.
I'm in the parking lot. I'm waiting for them because, you know, standard procedure is that they send the women out in another white van and they bring them to the main entrance. In a minute, I will go back in and see if the guard found out in the meantime whether the little boy is here or not. You know what, Debbie? Hang on a second because I see a white van coming.
Debbie, who's Madeline?
So Madeline is a local person who co-founded a group of mostly women, and they call themselves the Angry Tias and Abuelas. These are volunteers who've taken it upon themselves to try to make reunifications and the exits from Port Isabel more comfortable. So she's actually in this clip. She's outside of Port Isabel. She's been told that a woman is coming out with a 7-year-old boy, and she's getting ready to take that family in her car to a shelter. But she gets to the center, and what she was telling me on the phone was that nobody could tell her if the little boy was there. You know, so it's just another sort of aspect of this chaos. She couldn't get any information about where this child was or, in fact, if he was even there.
And, of course, as we mentioned, today's the deadline for reunification. What's your sense of what the next couple of days at Port Isabel will look like?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty much today, you know, what it was. And in the next couple of days, it's going to be extremely chaotic as, you know, the government tries to catch up. It still hasn't reunited everyone. And so then I think once there's a sense that these preliminary reunifications are done, they're going to be sort of playing catch up with people who are coming out of criminal detention. There were a lot of people who were late to get into immigration detention after those mass criminal trials for illegal entry. So there'll be people coming in, you know, who still need to be reunited with their kids. And, you know, there'll be like the TSN Abuelas still giving out backpacks at the bus stations. That's what they do. The shelters are still going to be seeing people. You know, and at Port Isabel in the future, we really shouldn't forget this. There's a lot of people who came up without their kids with asylum claims because of the violence they were fleeing in their countries. They're still there. Nobody's really paying attention to them. They've always been the majority of people at places like Port Isabel. So they're going to be suffering in ways similar that these people have, even though they didn't bring their kids. These are parents who left their children behind, but those are still separated families.
Debbie Nathan is a journalist based in Brownsville, Texas. Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The bottom line is, we have sent numerous letters to Rod Rosenstein. They haven't complied with two subpoenas. They haven't complied with. We've caught the Department of Justice hiding information, redacting information that they should not have redacted. We're tired of the Justice Department giving us the finger and not giving us the information we're entitled to do our constitutional duty. More importantly, the American people are sick of it.
That's Congressman Jim Jordan, who, by the way, is now running for Speaker of the House, talking to Fox News. And this week, members of the House Republican Freedom Caucus initiated articles of impeachment against Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Talk of Rosenstein's impeachment by Republicans has been heating up for months, but this is the first action being taken by lawmakers to advance the articles.
Really, for 9 months, we've asked for documents, and that's all we want are the documents. And what we found is not only have subpoenas been ignored, but information has been hidden. The efforts have been stonewalled. And I guess for us, it's all about transparency so the American people can judge for themselves. And so, you know, they may be able to ignore Congress, but they can't ignore the American people.
And that was Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina speaking to Fox. Meadows is one of the 11 representatives pushing to impeach Rosenstein. Ben Jacobs is a political reporter for The Guardian, and he's going to help us out here. And Ben, appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So articles of impeachment, what is the basis and who are bringing these articles of impeachment?
The basis, the articles of impeachment are pretty widely encompassing. They're being brought by 11 members of the Hard Right Freedom Caucus, who are strong Trump allies in the House. And it's trying to push Rod Rosenstein on the Justice Department and the views of these congressmen not sharing information with Congress, as well as for issues relating to the FISA application on Carter Page and the Russia investigation, and saying that it was all based on the Steele dossier.
I mean, okay, forgive my skepticism here, but this feels a little stunty, is it?
It's very stunty. There's no way that Rod Rosenstein would be impeached. The impeachment requires a majority in the House and then 2/3 in the Senate. And it's doubtful if it has even more than a handful of senators, and seems unclear if this will even get, you know, 218 Republicans, which is quite unlikely.
And we're also hearing reports now that Paul Ryan is also against this. We know that the House Freedom Caucus has done something like this before August recess. This isn't the first time that they've done something like this. What's their goal? And what are they actually trying to achieve other than perhaps a political stunt?
The goal is to try to press the Justice Department into sharing more information about the Russia investigation with the House. Justice Department has been hesitant about doing this. This is an ongoing criminal investigation, as well as the fact there are concerns with the behavior of some Republican congressmen close to Trump that, you know, sharing investigatory information will go right to the, you know, subject of the investigation, to the Trump administration, the White House. So this is really just an attempt to put more pressure on Rosenstein, the Justice Department, to be more cooperative with these House Republicans as the Russia investigation presses forward.
I mean, is there a sense that other members of the Republican Party are going to support this, or is this just something that's, you know, the latest in a series of pretty outrageous moves?
There's some. Steve Scalise, the number three Republican in the House, said it was, if this ended up being put to the floor for a vote, which is, and there's some procedural questions that whether that'll happen, he would vote for it. So that there's sort of a core of sort of Trumpist Republicans who will support this. But, you know, it's a question, you know, this doesn't end with Rod Rosenstein getting impeached, let alone impeached and convicted. It's just another way to signal displeasure with the Russia investigation and its handling by the Justice Department.
Ben Jacobs is a political reporter for The Guardian. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Five months ago, 17 students and teachers were killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. The shooting set off a wave of activism aimed at changing the way Americans react to gun violence. And while Congress has taken little action, individual states are responding. A new analysis by the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonprofit policy organization founded in part by former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, found that following Parkland, 55 new gun control laws have passed in 26 states. The author of that analysis, managing attorney Allison Anderman, joins me now. Thanks for being with us, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a sense of what some are examples of the type of legislation we're seeing pass in different states this year.
I think the most significant of the policies that we saw enacted after Parkland were extreme risk protection order laws that allow a family member or law enforcement officer to petition a court for an order temporarily removing guns from a dangerous person. This was a policy that had been developed by key researchers and advocates in the gun violence prevention movement over the course of several years, but really gained traction after the Isla Vista massacre in 2014, in which the family members of the shooter knew that he was dangerous. And between 2014 and 2016, three states enacted these laws. But after Parkland, we saw eight additional states enact these policies.
And do these laws go far enough in order to prevent mass shootings?
These are very powerful tools because they allow the people closest to the potential shooters to intervene. In so many of these mass shootings, we have seen that community members and family members saw warning signs that the shooter was dangerous. And these policies, which were based off of laws in Connecticut and Indiana that have been in place for almost two decades, have been very successfully used to prevent gun suicides, which actually make up the majority of gun deaths in the United States. And it's a similar situation. Family members or loved ones often know that the person is in crisis. And so this is an extremely powerful tool. And I think that it will go a long way towards preventing gun deaths in the United States.
I mean, this has been a hot button political issue for so many reasons. We've seen this play out in Congress. But many of the states that are enacting these laws are actually run by Republican governors. Is that not right?
That is right. This year, we saw 15 Republican governors sign gun safety legislation. And we also saw the governor of Oklahoma take a very brave step in defying the gun lobby and vetoing their one of their signature pieces of legislation, which is permitless carry, allowing people to carry hidden, loaded guns in public without a permit or a background check.
And so in the wake of a lot of these previous high-profile mass shootings, why do you think it's the Parkland shooting that has really prompted a lot of this change?
For decades prior to the shooting, survivors and other activists in the gun violence prevention movement have been laying the groundwork for this type of action. We've been meeting with policymakers, educating them about these policies, researching the effectiveness of these policies, and really doing everything we can to prime the movement for this moment. And I think what happened after Parkland was we had a group of extremely articulate young people who had very talented with social media and messaging, utilize what had been laid before them to promote this message. It was a new voice. And also, I think the country is really waking up to the fact that this is the legacy that we're leaving to the next generation. And that's a very powerful message in and of itself.
Allison Anderman is the managing attorney for the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The state of Florida has passed at least four pieces of anti-gun legislation in the months since the Parkland shooting. But a fatal shooting last week is now raising questions about the state's newly revised Stand Your Ground law. Last Thursday, Marquise McLaughlin was fatally shot by a man carrying a concealed weapon in the parking lot of a convenience store. The shooter, Michael Draca, got into an argument with McLaughlin's girlfriend over a parking spot. McLaughlin, who is black, heard about it and confronted Draca, who is white. He pushed Draca to the ground, and then Draca shot and killed him. Citing Florida's Stand Your Ground law, local law enforcement has elected not to charge Draca. Here's Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Galtieri talking about the shooting on Friday.
You know, before Stand Your Ground, a case like this probably would have a different outcome.
About half of the states in the United States have Stand Your Ground laws on the books. And here to explain is John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford University.
Well, as you mentioned, about half the states now have a Stand Your Ground statute. And the rest of the states do not have a Stand Your Ground statute, but have some variation of their defense provisions determined by either a statute or by just general judge-made common law.
And I think there are lots of misinterpretations or just interpretations of what Stand Your Ground means. Is there one sort of way to explain it, even though we know that in each state it's slightly different?
Yes. I mean, in general, the new Stand Your Ground movement has largely tried to bulk up the right of self-defense in a way to give individuals the right to avoid a common law doctrine that prevailed for centuries in England and the United States in many jurisdictions, that you have a duty to retreat. So if you can avoid injuring someone, you're not allowed to use deadly force in those jurisdictions that still maintain that duty to retreat. Stand Your Ground jurisdictions, if you're in a place where you are allowed to be, you don't have to retreat. And if you're feeling a threat of imminent bodily injury or fear of death, you're allowed to use deadly force to defend yourself.
Without prosecution, is that right?
That's right.
Then we know that Florida specifically changed its Stand Your Ground law last year to shift the burden of proof onto prosecutors. What effect does that shift have? Because I think when many people think of Stand Your Ground, that's where they think Florida.
Yeah, and the Florida statute is probably about as strong for those who want to assert a very vigorous right to self-defense as any jurisdiction. As you mentioned, there is a question of who has the burden of establishing that the use of deadly force was legitimate. And in Florida now, the burden rests on the prosecutor when someone is asserting that they have used self-defense. The burden is now on the prosecutor to prove that that was not a legitimate use of self-defense. And that reverses the traditional common law view that someone who asserts the use of force must raise that as a defense and has the burden of establishing that it was a legitimate use of force.
I also want to talk about, I want to go back a little bit to the history. You mentioned the Stand Your Ground sort of movement. Can you give us a sense of who is behind this, when this started taking effect, and why this is suddenly something that we're seeing in so many, in half the states in our country?
Well, I think it sort of emanates out of the NRA movement to try to expand the right to carry guns outside the home. So as states started to pass right to carry laws, more and more individuals were carrying guns outside the home, and that led to confrontations. And so the NRA perceived that sales would be hampered if individuals who were carrying guns were starting to be arrested and prosecuted for using them. And so they were then behind the efforts to essentially make it easier to use guns in those settings outside the home.
So one of the, when we think about Stand Your Ground, we saw a case in Florida last week where a black man was killed in a Florida parking lot, and supposedly there was the use of Stand Your Ground there. We've also seen Stand Your Ground also in the state of Florida, and I'm thinking specifically of the case of Marissa Alexander, who is a black woman who used the same defense, in fact, did not kill anyone, shot into the air, I believe, a warning shot, and was not able to call into her defense the Stand Your Ground provision. Are we seeing this Stand Your Ground provisions being used disproportionately or benefiting disproportionately white Americans as opposed to Americans of color?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly many of the recent episodes of Stand Your Ground use in Florida have involved cases of white individuals shooting a minority individual. And in general, there's a lot of reason to be apprehensive about the aggressive use of Stand Your Ground in this case, because you know, some recent research has shown that it's easier to feel apprehension when there's an other confronting you, and racial lines can often divide that otherness. So there's real concern. And then, of course, if you are seeing prosecutors employ this in a way that maybe is appealing to their constituents, you worry if, you know, minority status is leading to worse outcomes for those individuals.
Well, and we're also seeing in this particular case in Florida, the sheriff has decided that he will not prosecute the person involved in this shooting, and actually said before Stand Your Ground, a case like this probably would have had a different outcome. Is this putting a lot more power and discretion into places that, or into people's hands that necessarily shouldn't have it?
I think America is sort of going down the wrong path right now. And in most of the other advanced industrialized nations, there's a concerted effort on the part of government to reduce the likelihood that anyone will be shot. So Stand Your Ground is a very strong movement in the other direction. And I think you see some of the negative consequences of that move.
John Donahue is a professor of law at Stanford University. John, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to chat.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
I didn't ruin it. You did. So stop twisting everything.
Can we talk about this?
Can we talk about what?
Get out before I kill you.
So your life's unfair, so what? That's how it is. So they're mean-girling you in the press. They're calling you names that hurt your little soft spots deep inside. Well, so what?
So when you're out there running all day, who wins?
Snap out of it! Started that damn company without me. Hell, I'll work my ass off!
In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Mother.
I'm not going to be ignored, Dad.
Oh my God, you have been sending me all these mixed signals.
You're always talking about what you give and what you don't have to give. But you take too, Troy. You take.
You let me on. You made me believe you wanted to marry me.
Now, Scarlett, be fair.
You did. It's true, you did. I hate you till I die. I can't think of anything bad enough. Holy
All right, ladies, all week long, we've been talking about women's anger and rage in this series we're calling Hysterical Women in Rage. And today we're wrapping things up with a conversation about how portrayals of women's anger in popular culture are seen and the way we are shown getting mad in movies and television and in music shape our expectations and actually stereotype around the way women should and shouldn't behave. So our guests today, we've got Angelica Jade Bastian, a staff writer for New York Magazine's website Vulture, and she joins us from Chicago. Hi, Angelica.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. And guess what, everybody? Remember this song?
I'm hungry, I'm dirty, I'm losing my mind. Everything's fine.
Well, Well, we've got the woman behind that rage in studio as well, Tracy Bonham. Tracy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Angelica, Tracy, we're going to break it down today. Thanks both of you for joining us. Tracy, I want to start with you. This was just a crazy song. Mother, Mother came out in 1996, and God forbid I'm now probably outing myself in terms of my age here.
We don't have to discuss that.
22 years ago. But it was such a powerful song, and it was one of my favorite songs to rage to. So where did it come from?
It came from a lifelong, really, really kind of a maladapted habit to just suppress my anger and not be able to actually vocalize and express it in my daily life and with my mom or with friends or with anyone. And so luckily I had music as an outlet.
I mean, there were two of me and another guest that we had on who just had this moment where it was like, oh, my God, you too. You are also reaching out to it. And it was a moment, I think, back in the 90s, mid-90s in particular, when we had Luscious Jackson, The Breeders, Hole, Tori Amos, yeah. You. Like, there was so – what was happening in that moment that you think led to so many women really raging out in music?
Well, I don't know. I think the music business caught on to it. And it was great, though. I enjoyed it, for sure.
We're still talking about it 20-some-odd years later.
Exactly.
Angelica, let's shift a little bit to TV, movies, and all this other media that's out there. What are some of the worst instances of angry or rageful women that you've seen in film or television?
I think the worst instances, at least the ones who are really embedded in my mind, happen to be the femme fatales we saw in the early 90s, who, unlike their classic film brethren, actually survive and get what they want. And on the surface, that's very provocative and fascinating, but at the same time, their anger is treated as something abnormal. And so that's true for like films like The Last Seduction, Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, which I think are very contradictory in how they portray female anger.
There is one scene from the Sex and the City movie that I want to play because I thought this was a pretty good representation of anger. Let's take a listen.
I knew you would do this! I knew it!
Carrie, I'm sorry.
I am humiliated!
I'm sorry, Carrie. Carrie, wait, I'm sorry. Carrie,
no!
Wait.
No!
So, Carrie had just gotten left at the altar. Angelica, do you remember that?
I do. I knew that was the scene you were talking about when you said you were going to show something from the first Sex and the City movie. I mean, I'd be mad, too.
But just, I mean, at the end of the day, she ends up with Mr. Big anyway. So did that anger actually play out in a positive way? I mean, I don't know.
I mean, what does it mean for a woman's anger to be positive in pop culture? Does it mean that it never ends, it's all consuming? Does it mean she expresses it without repercussion? I mean, that's a complicated question. With Carrie, I mean, let's be real, she's kind of a mess. We all knew she was eventually going to marry this man.
I want to ask you,
continue to be a mess.
They continue to be a mess, although we don't want to admit this, I think. But more generally speaking, let's talk about where we are today. And Tracy and Angelica, I'm curious, both of you, do you think we're getting better at either allowing women to be angry? And I hate to say allowing, because it almost seems like we need to ask permission to be angry, or just supporting that rage and allowing for that to be part of our creative expression. Tracy?
Well, I do think so. I mean, I think that it's incredibly positive. However, I know that the media kind of took it a little far, but the Me Too movement, we are hearing now from women who had suppressed for years. And I think we're interested and men are paying attention. And I think that we're using that as a platform. It's a very, very positive thing.
Angelica, what do you think? Are there better examples than, say, the Fatal Attractions out there?
I think that's complicated. Yes and no. You know, there's a lot of really interesting portrayals of female anger just this year. I think that's really the theme for TV and film this year. We've seen stuff like The Americans, The Good Fight, the novels of Megan Abbott. She has a new one called Give Me Your Hand. And Sharp Objects. But then at the same time, you're seeing something like The Handmaid's Tale. I think The Handmaid's Tale really represents a trend I don't like with modern portrayals of anger, in which women's anger needs to be justified by routine sexual assault and brutalization as if it's not valid unless that's happening. On the flip side, in the in the pre-code era in Hollywood. And in the 1940s, you had actresses like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, who portrayed anger with such beautiful nuance, which I don't see a lot of today, not in the same way.
I'm thinking that, particularly when it comes to portrayals of women of color, Angelica, we know that, exactly. And like, what can you tell us about portrayals of Black and brown women getting angry in front of the camera?
Well, one thing that's interesting to me about women's anger is it is so complicated by a host of factors. For Black women, and I'm just going to speak as a Black woman, as an Afro-Latina, with us, anger is sort of expected. We don't even have to do anything angry to be perceived as angry. And the idea of the angry Black woman is an all-encompassing stereotype that we still see traces of. And with Black women, you know, you get, you know, Viola Davis really plays with anger in her work in a way that feels like righteous and complicated and beautiful at times. But we don't really get a lot of portrayals like that, where a Black woman or a brown woman is the lead and her anger is taken seriously. A lot of times it can be played off as a joke, which you saw in a lot of sitcoms in the 90s or 90s yeah. Wayne's Brothers films, you know, that sort of mess.
Like Jerry Springer
Yeah, exactly. Right,
bad portrayal.
Yeah, and for Black women, especially, I think anger, for Black and brown women, that actually, anger is a revolutionary force. It's been used to start movements like, you know, Black Lives Matter. So I think I would like to see more portrayals that tap into that side of Black women's anger, especially.
Angelica, Tracy, really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angelica Jade Bastian is a staff writer for Vulture. Tracy Bonham's most recent album is Modern Burden.
Mother, mother, can you hear me? I'm just calling to say hello.
And that's our show for today. Find all the stories from our hysterical series at thetakeaway.org/women. And we covered what the research says about angry women, rage in the workplace, and we have a great roundtable with three women who are channeling their rage for good.
Be comfortable with not pleasing people.
It's something that can be used constructively or destructively.
May your rage be a force for good.
I'm hungry, dirty, I'm losing my mind.
Thanks so much for raging with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.